Good afternoon, it's 1:32 on Thursday, January 25th, and Representative, President or Representative Ortiz, Representative Pruitt, Representative Wilson, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Tilton, Representative Grant, Representative Thompson, myself, Co-Chair Seaton, and today, remind everybody about their cell phones again. And we will hear from department budget overviews from the Department of Education and Early Development, Environmental Conservation, and the Alaska Court System. So, Commissioner Johnson, would you come forward? And with any other people you want to tag along? Presentation. Since there are two female voices, the women get to say their first name if they're answering a question or something, so we can get there. Would you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record?
All right, for the record, Representative Seaton, my name is Michael Johnson. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Education and Early Development, and I'll let my colleagues put themselves on the record.
Hi, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Santa Eford. I'm Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Education and Early Development.
And Heidi Teschner, Director of Administrative Services with the Department of Education and Early Development.
And I think you'll need to pull the mic closer when you're speaking. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Thank you. And in the room with us.
Before we start, we'll have to cut this off about 2:10, so we have about 35 minutes.
Yes, sir. In the room with us, we have the department's budget analyst, Rhonda Biles. If you could just wave when I say your name. From the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, we have Director Stephanie Butler and Finance Director Charlene Morrison. And then we also have the department's legislative liaison, Marcy Herman, in the audience. The Alaska Constitution, Article 7, Section 1. Says that the legislature shall by general law establish and maintain a system of public schools open to all children of the state and may provide for other public educational institutions. Schools and institutions so established shall be free from sectarian control. No money shall be paid from the public funds for the direct benefit of any religious or other private educational institution. And the purpose of education, as stated in statute, is it is the policy of this state that the purpose of education is to help ensure that all students will succeed in their education and work, shape worthwhile and satisfying lives for themselves, exemplify the best values of society, and be effective in improving the character and the quality of the world about them. And the mission of the department, as established by the State Board of Education, is an excellent education for every student every day. And the State Board adopted as their vision statement the legislature's statute there, 1403-015. And with that, I'll turn it over to Heidi Teschner, our Director of Finance.
So again, for the record, Heidi Teschner. The chart on slide 3 shows the committee a 10-year look back of our non-formula appropriations in the department's budget and therefore our unrestricted and our designated general funds, and it's compared to all agency budgets. The department's total general fund budget is $46,113,800, of which about $32 million is our unrestricted general funds and $14 million is our designated general funds. Since FY15, the unrestricted general funds for the departments and our non-formula appropriations has been reduced by $25.3 million, or about 44.2%. A particular note on this slide is the increase in FY15 that you're noting, which was attributed to the passage of HB 278, which was the education bill. And some of the items that included in that legislation were funds for the college and career readiness assessment, the middle school STEM 3-year pilot project, and the school broadband access grants. The chart on slide 4 is again a 10-year look back of our formula and non-formula appropriations. The one on the chart on the previous slide are shown on this graph in the blue lines, and are, so that's the non-formula portion. And the red is the formula. It's the largest part of the department's budget, and this includes our foundation program, our pupil transportation program, boarding home grants, special schools, youth in detention, and the Alaska Performance Scholarship Awards. Formulas are about 96% of our overall budget, and the non-formula is about 4%. And again, the increase you're noting in FY15 is related to HB 278, the education bill.
And before we go to the next slide, I want to recognize that Representative Burge has joined us.
On slide 5, again, a 10-year look back of the non-formula appropriations by line item and fund source. And this is for all funds. So this is our unrestricted, designated, federal, and other funding. A particular note on these slides is in FY 10 and 12. And in FY 10, this is attributed to the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funding that we received. And in FY 2012, it was related to the BTOP, the Broadband Technology Opportunity Program funding that the department received. And on,
thank you. And on slide 5, so what is the increase for on the commodities level from 1.5 to 1.6?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I'm trying to recall what that might be in there. I don't know off the top of my head what is contributing to specifically to that increase, but I'm happy to follow up with the committee.
Thank you.
On slide 6, this is a 10-year look back of our non-formula appropriations in the department's budget for all fund sources. Education, support, and administrative services is the largest portion of the department's budget, and that's the blue line you're seeing across the top. In FY19's governor budget, this is a reorganization. We combined two appropriations, the education support services and teaching and learning support, into the education support and administrative services. And the peaks you're seeing on the blue line are attributed to the ERA funding and the education jobs funds, federal funding that the department received. On slide 7, this provides the committee a look back of the non-formula appropriations in the department's budget for our general funds only. So this is designated and unrestricted general funds. Again, education support and administrative services is the largest portion of the department's budget, and that is the non-formula portion of the department's budget. I guess that's the pink line you're seeing. Let's see here. Increases from FY09 through FY13 include additions of funding for the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, Best Beginnings, Parents to Teachers, among some other grant funding. And reductions that you're seeing from FY15 through 17 include a repeal of the high school graduation qualifying exam, as well as reduction in personal services and budget positions. Since FY15, the department's lost 81 positions.
And before we go further, Representative Ortiz has a question.
Yeah.
Okay. Actually, he was first, I believe.
Mr. Chair. That doesn't matter at all. Representative Pruitt, if you had your hand up first, go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's between the two. I'm just trying to understand the state facilities rent. I see that we have a stable amount in the management to government or to the governor's adjusted for out of GF. But then I noticed that in all funds, it's a decrease of about $2 million. What has changed that we've been able – have we been able to reduce our rent, or is that what's kind of that quirk there?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, there's actually a couple things going on here. We have reduced our leased space, so we have provided some funding savings through that. The other thing that you're seeing is an FY19 governor's budget. We did a kind of a restructure where we moved a few of the appropriations that were previously under state facilities rent into different appropriations. For instance, we had the state facilities maintenance that oversaw Mount Edgecombe High School, and that is now underneath the Mount Edgecombe Boarding School appropriation. So you're going to see those amounts reflected in the totals you see here for, well, Mount Edgecombe's not on here because they, I don't know why they're not on here. But you would see them in here. And then we also moved funding we have for the Andrew P. Kesher-Viroff Museum, Libraries, Archives, and Museums funding. That's been moved underneath the Libraries, Archives, and Museums appropriation.
And before we go to Representative Ortiz, Representative Guttenberg has joined us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Heidi, you talked about since FY15, the department is down, DEED is down 44% in funding. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that is correct.
And you're talking about how many positions have been eliminated since FY15?
Since FY15, 81 positions. Across the entire department, and the 44% reduction is in our non-formula portion of the budget.
Okay. So can you kind of give a summary or an overview of how those reductions have impacted our ability, if in any way, to meet the overall mission of DEED and fulfill its obligations to fulfilling the mission?
Can you share? Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, for the record, this is Santa Efer, Deputy Commissioner. What we're facing right now in the department is kind of a shift in the balance of our federally supported and funded positions versus the general fund more flexible positions that we could do other things with. So right now we have about 25% of our positions that are fully UGF. And so we really find ourselves at times being compliance and monitoring through our federal programs. And yes, that's a very important role for the department, and we need to do that. But we also need to be looking at ways we can be more flexible to reach out and support our districts. And so there kind of lies that kind of the dilemma that we're in at times of being able to reach out and do some of the things that are not the federally mandated pieces that we need to do. For instance, we've lost our content specialist throughout those years and don't have that support to go out to the district. So those are some of the things that we're facing. We've also lost positions within our fiscal and accounting, and we're looking at ways to make things more efficient. So, I mean, just across the board in the department, there have been cuts in every program and every section.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate that, Santa. But the question, I guess, is I would think that if DEED is down 44% in funding and you have 88 less positions, there must be some direct impacts on what happens to that kid going to elementary school in the lower Kuskokwim or in Ketchikan or something. Can you see a direct impact on the quality of education by those reductions or not? Maybe we've been able to withstand those cuts and still not harm delivery of services to the kid in the classroom.
I can take that one through the chair. Representative Ortiz, the impact for the third grade student in a classroom in a school, I think, is something particularly apparent in especially our rural areas, though, you know, I'm not excluding our urban areas. But as DEED's capacity shrinks, then we are less able to support, especially our small districts and our small schools, with some of the compliance issues that go along with federal
work. And so that work at times can get shifted to the district and then to a school and then to the staff there that are working with students. And so that can be an impact on a student in a classroom. I think that one of the things that DEED could do for districts is support some of those compliance issues, but also, for example, staff development and providing more of that directly to districts so that especially small districts are not trying to do that individually. Data collection, but particularly data reporting, because I think one of DEED's important roles is to make sure Alaskans know about the schools that their students attend with data that describes that school, achievement, teacher turnover, all sorts of things. But many of our small districts don't have the capacity to collect and report that data, so DEED would be able to do that. So we don't have that capability anymore as we may have once. But I will say I'll also use the opportunity to commend the staff at the department that throughout this time of cuts, there are aspects of the department that we are no longer able to do as we once did, but they have worked very hard to keep up a level of service for our school districts.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Yeah, thank you. I do want to go to the Mount Edgecombe Boarding School. I see on the GF only, of course, we made the change to the public school trust that was made last year. Not seeing that line on the other one, the all funds. I guess my question is, have we seen an increase? Is there an increase proposed by the administration this year in that Mount Edgecombe Boarding School funding? And is that where we wrap in the difference in rent that might have been shifted over to Mount Edgecombe? Not seeing it on the other form, I can't answer that question myself.
Again, for the record, Heidi Teschner, through the chair, Representative Pruitt. The increases for Mount Edgecombe in the 19 governor's budget is an increase for $250,000 for federal receipt authority so they can accept federal grants directly and not have to go through reimbursable service agreements with the department. And then a $250,000 increase for interagency receipt authority, and that helps them receive the full foundation and other federal funding they get from department to Mount Edgecombe through the appropriations. There isn't the other changes for Mount Edgecombe is just the switch from adding they already had the authority in Mount Edgecombe. There's two components for Mount Edgecombe Boarding School. So one of them already had the authority given to the interagency receipt authority for that they got from Mount Edgecombe Boarding School's component to the state facilities rent component or state facilities maintenance component. So it's really just a switch to put that all underneath one larger appropriation. Am I making sense?
So just to follow up, make sure I understand. And I'll just simplify it because we don't have a lot of time. I guess the question I think that I could ask is are we seeing an increase this year in Mount Edgecombe? And really the question comes because we had a there was a bill earlier today that was talking about changing the effect the mechanism in which we provide funding from the public trust. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what do we expect the draw from Mount Edgecombe to be from that? Trying to balance two things and understanding if we're going to be overdrawing from the fund, what the stability of the fund. So I guess if you can answer how much is coming from that public trust fund and does it affect the stability of it in the long term?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, it's about $4.6 million that's coming from the public school trust fund for Mount Edgecombe. And that is not an increase.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Further questions, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being patient, being late. So in the box right in the middle, the broadband access grants, is this the state's contribution left over after the E-rate's been paid, or what is this? right, for libraries. Mm-hmm. The E-rate pays the large 90%. The local communities pay half of that, and the state pays theoretically 5% of that. Is that what this is, or is that something else?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, what this is, the school broadband access grants are it's funding to bring schools up to 10 megabits of download speed per second. So it's funding that was put into HB 278, the education bill, and it allows to help help districts pay for that internet fee to help bring their speed up to 10 megabits a second.
If I may, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So is that a capital or is that an operating expense? So is it more equipment or is it just paying for more speed?
Through the chair, it is. It's not capital, and it is just help pay for that that fee.
Okay. Is there a match? If I may, Mr. Chair, is a matching grant? Is there federal money? Is there local contributions, or is it just what we're paying?
Through the chair, districts are still eligible for their E-rate, and they still get the E-rate portion of it. This just helps offset the additional costs it costs to bring them up to 10 megabits.
Okay. And if I may, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. The 10 megabits is the standard, which was lowered from 25, which was lowered from 100 from the FCC. Are these rural or urban libraries, or are they just across the state?
Through the chair, if my memory serves me, it's across the state, but we can provide that list to the committee if that would be helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd love to see a list of both the libraries, the E-rate that the feds pay, the state, and the local contribution. That would be great. Thank you.
Yes. Slide 8 is our last look-back graph. And this just shows for our K-12 aid to school districts, our formula programs, all funds. So people, transportation, and foundation are the primary ones, the blue lines being foundation and the red line. People, trans, and the green is the couple years that we had outside the formula funding. So the next few slides, we're going to provide the similar chart by results delivery unit in the department. And just to kind of go across what each of the columns mean and how we filled it out, the obviously we have the allocation and our program noted in the far left column. And then the column after that is our funding. Total funding is in bold, and then if it's multiple funding sources, it's noted below it. Then followed by our total number of budgeted and filled full-time, part-time, and non-perm positions, and then the number of Alaskans served, the percent of cost through fees that we collect, the rating of importance. We gave ourselves a grade of an A, B, or C. A was meaning we were getting the job done, B, getting the job done, but there was areas for improvement, and C, we're not getting the job done with limited opportunity for improvement. And these are the department's performance, not any reflection on school districts. And then the last three columns note whether or not they are constitutionally required, federally, or statutorily required. And in the interest of time, I'm not going to go over every item in each of these following slides, but do want to point out some highlights and just note that the foundation formula is fully funded at the base student allocation of $5,930, and pupil transportation is fully funded in the governor's budget based on the statutory formula.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I guess you give yourself an A for the foundation program because somebody writes the check out. So where does the effectiveness, the reading levels, I mean, I pulled the report cards off my own district, and we're failing. We have more that are below efficiency than we have at efficient or above. So where in the matrix of these pages does the department then utilize whether or not these funds are getting the job done?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. So the report card you referenced is
And so through the accountability system that the department has, through our what was No Child Left Behind plan, now it's the Every Student Succeeds Act plan, that accountability program is designed to measure the effectiveness of instruction and what's happening at our local schools. And I'll reference back to my comment about data going to each community and providing the people in those communities with information about their schools and how well those schools are performing.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up for everyone, Will.
So you do the data, and I'm all about data, so that's great. But if a school, and you pick any school, you go in and you have a discussion and you show the scores and the scores don't change, then what happens?
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, in the I'm going to reference the new Every Student Succeeds Act plan, which goes into effect this year and next year. There is in there mechanisms for schools that are identified as needing comprehensive levels of support, targeted levels of support, and then in the plan, and we can get you a copy of that plan, it identifies mechanisms and things the department can do to support those districts in improving their student achievement.
Follow-up. But still, what happens? I mean, I'm not trying to put you in a box, but if our education system makes it so a third grader still can't read, you know, I'm not even talking about a third grade level, we now as a state have made choices for him or her on what they can be, because we know you can't do anything if you can't read efficiently. So, you know, we're failing at that, and we've been doing that. We've had the discussion here. We've had in other portions of it. But at the end of the day, you know, you're the commissioner, and so if you get into a district and you don't do those things, is there a plan to where the state has some kind of resources to make sure that if they're not going to put it in place, then does the state do it, or do we just continue to get the same, you know, keep giving funds and just – having talks?
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, I'll try to answer that question as honestly as I can. And that would be, I wish, particularly for children that can't read, that there were a checklist of five things I could do to fix that. But unfortunately, our schools reflect our society. And so as you as a legislature spends money on opioid epidemics, crime, health issues, the impacts of those walk through the classroom doors every single day. And so I wish that I could give you a very direct, concrete step one, two, three answer. And I wish that, because then we could really help children in a lot more concrete, easy way. Having said that, we have most of the authority for school districts rest with the locally elected school board. And so the department has a limited amount of authority to go into a school and change practice. We do have some, and that's reflected particularly in the ESSA plan that we submit to the federal government and associated regulation. Other than that, we have a limited amount of authority, but I don't want to leave the impression that I, as commissioner, and many of my colleagues at the Department of Education don't use our relationships and our observations and our relationships with partners in the state to try to impact those changes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I was late. Commissioner, can you go back to page 8 just for a second? It's been a struggle for many of us to sort of convince our colleagues not to cut education funding. Last year there was a proposed $70 million cut and the elimination of pre-K, and in the end we were able to restore pre-K and avoid that $70 million proposed cut. But I guess, is it realistic for, you know, looking back at FY15 till today, as much as we've been struggling to battle the proposals for education cuts and succeeded so far, comparing today to FY15, there's less money going to the classroom. Is it realistic for us to expect that by putting less money in the classroom, not even including the funding that's eaten away by inflation, is it realistic to expect academic achievement to increase in that atmosphere?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra. It certainly is more difficult with less resources. And that's partly because of the complexity, as I discussed with Representative Wilson, that the complexities in the lives of our students, you know, it makes it a challenging context in many situations. So I don't think it's accurate to say that necessarily the effectiveness is directly tied to the amount of dollars going in, but certainly I think it's safe to say that the amount of resources going into the system has an impact on being able to address those complexities.
Go ahead, and we have about 7 minutes.
Okay.
So slide 10 shows our education support administrative services results delivery unit and the components underneath that. Just a couple of things to highlight in the governor's budget. There's a $100,000 unrestricted general fund one-time increment in student school achievement, which will help us with developing, updating, and adopting the new science standards, which haven't been updated since 2006 and currently are not in compliance with the Every Student Succeeds Act. So we need to bring those up to compliance. And then in our early learning coordination, $1.2 million base budget increment to continue the one-time item that was put in FY18's budget that was to help the continue with the more pre-K students. On this slide, we'll show the for our Alaska State Council on the Arts, our commissions and boards, which is our Professional Teaching Practices Commission, and the Mount Edgecombe Boarding School. And just to note again that the Mount Edgecombe facilities maintenance has been added underneath the Mount Edgecombe Boarding School results delivery unit, as well as we are transferring 7 of the positions that was in our facilities maintenance to the Department of Transportation for the Division of Facilities Services for FY19. The state facilities rent results delivery unit is our education or EED state facilities rent, which and then the Alaska State Libraries, Archives, and Museums. To note in there, so in library operations, the school broadband access grants, there is a $135,900 designated general funds. This is coming from the Alaska Higher Education Fund that reduces the school broadband access grants. And this just brings the grants into alignment, the balance, the authorization into alignment with the demand for the for that grant, and doesn't affect anything at the schools or the libraries that receive that funding. And then in our museum operations, there's a $105,600 unrestricted general fund reduction for the elimination of the funding for the museum grant and aid program. That section maintains. And then continuing with Alaska State Libraries, Archives, and Museums, the Andrew P. Kashevirov Facilities Maintenance was added as a separate component underneath this results delivery unit to provide some more transparency on what it costs to maintain that facility. And then finally, our Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education Commission, the Alaska State Performance Scholarship Awards and Alaska Student Loan Corporations are the final results delivery units in the department's budget. And just to point out, within the governor's budget, there is a $81,600 designated general funds coming from the Higher Education Investment Fund for the an increment to for projected increases in the WAMI medical education contractual obligations.
Mr. Chair. On the point that you just highlighted there, obviously that has been a concern at the WAMI coming out of the higher education fund, along with the multiple other things in there, would draw on it. I guess my question is more of how will increases affect the longevity of the fund and the ability for it to continue to do pay out, not just for the initial what it was intended for, but now that we've added everything else onto it for all of the things that are continuing to draw on it. How stable is that fund?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I can't speak to the stability of the fund itself because it's not a fund that we manage or have control over. I might have to ask Ledge Finance to help answer that question or get back to you on that question.
Thank you, Ms. Chair.
Okay, and would you get back to us?
Yes.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will get my answer outside of the room in the interest of time.
Thank you.
And this is our final slide, just providing the committee with the health care costs and the Department of Education's budget. So the total health budgeted health care cost shown in the gray line, and that comparison to our total budget, which does not include the foundation or the pupil transportation program, and what that percent is to our what the percent of the healthcare cost is to the budget. So it's decreased to 1.5% from FY14's, which was what 1.9%. And that was our presentation. We welcome any other questions the committee might have.
And that will be interesting. So the healthcare is only the department itself, not any of the schools.
Chair Seaton, that is correct. This is just the department.
Are there further questions in 10 seconds? No.
Too late. Right.
Okay, we'll take, thank you very much. We'll thank take you. A brief at ease while we switch to message.
Thank you.
Okay, we're back in order. Welcome, Department of Environmental Conservation. Commissioner, would you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Larry Hartig. I'm the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. And with me this afternoon is Tom Cherian. He's our Admin Services Director.
Great. And as you go forward, two male voices, so just say your first name so we get it in the record as we switch.
Thank you. Okay, as I mentioned, my name is Larry Hartig, and I'll start by talking about our department mission. Simply stated, is to protect human health and the environment. A more specific statement is found in the cites to the statutes, the summaries of the statutes, and then at the bottom of the page you have the references there to the four specific statutes that set out our duties. But when I think about the mission and the duties of the department, I think about it in terms of three interconnected circles. One would be human health, one would be animal health, and the last would be environmental health, because the health of people, animals, and the environment are inextricably linked to each other. And this is called the One Health concept and guides how many federal and state agencies with responsibilities for protecting health approach their work and build their programs. And that'll be a theme that you'll hear today, and particularly through the subcommittee hearings, of how we integrate those three sets of duties. This next slide just simply gives you the references. I won't go through those.
And Commissioner, just so you know, we do have to cut off at 2:50 is our time slot.
Thank you. The third slide here, this gives you an overview of our GF spending going back to 2009. It would be the UGF and DGF. You can see it peaked in fiscal year 14. That's when we took on the 404 permitting program, dredge and fill program. And then that went out of our budget the next year, and then you start seeing the declines as all the budgets tightened. Over this period since fiscal year 14, we haven't added any programs. Some of the programs, there's a little bit of expansion in the drinking water program as we take on some federal rules. The bottom right, you can see that our total general fund portion of this whole state general fund operating budget is about 0.85%. If you looked at just the UGF, we're about 0.38% of the state UGF budget. The box on the left is two quick points. One is you would see that over this period we've taken a drop in UGF of about $2.2 million, but that the DGF has gone up over that period a little bit to offset that. We expect that growth in DGF, which includes our, basically for DEC, that would include our permitting fees, and it would include the response fund that we get on the crude oil surcharge and the 0.95 cents a gallon on refined product. We expect that to level off because we think that we've kind of maxed ourselves out on the fees. One, because we're bumping up against the statutory limits that we have on get fees for our indirect costs, and we have statutory barriers against collecting our indirect. So we don't expect that we'll be able to do much more fund source switching from UGF to DGF. Next slide. This gives you an overview of how we spend the funds that we get. This is the funds from all different sources, including UGF, DGF, federal, and other. I'll talk a little bit more about other in a minute. The majority of what we spend goes towards personnel services. That's the blue area, blue bars that you see there. Those are things that we can't directly control. Those are negotiated through union contracts and health insurance agreements, that sort of thing. If you look down below, you'll see in that the table there the different funds, the things that we spend our funds on. Just about all of them have gone down over this time period. Even personal services has gone down from that high year of 2014. Travel's gone down significantly. But I expect that will actually climb a little bit, and I say that for several reasons. One is one of the impacts of the cuts that we've been taking is we cut back on inspections that we do. You know, our inspectors go travel to get to some of the locations we have to look at. And what we're seeing is with that tightening of travel, we're not getting our job done, and so we're going to have to increase there. There's also some pent-up training that needs to be done, and then we're seeing a little bit more travel with the change in federal administration and some travel getting to know the new people and getting called to meetings there. So there'll be a bump up on that. Next slide.
Let's go back one slide to slide 4 for a moment. When you were there, you wrapped up by saying you were bumping up against the statutory prohibition. So that's on the 0.95 and the 5 cents per barrel or 4 cents per barrel?
No, Mr. Chairman. I could talk to that too, but we have another issue there. But what I was talking about on those are two components to our DGF. One is our permit fees that we collect, and that's where we're hitting this statutory barrier. There's two statutes that underlie our fee authority, and they put caps on how much of our direct expenses we can recoup through permit fees, and then it puts prohibitions against collecting our indirect expenses back through permit fees. We've had discussions both in Senate Finance and Health Finance over the last 3 or 4 years about that, but we'd certainly welcome that discussion again if there was an appetite for revisiting that.
Thank you.
This next page just shows you the different divisions that we have in DEC and what their history has been on spending all funds going back to 2009 to the proposed 19 budget. I'll start at the bottom quickly and work up here. At the bottom is at the Division of Administration. And you can see that there's a slight uptick over the last couple of years on that. And that's primarily because we've consolidated some of the services and other programs, other divisions like Division of Water, and brought those under the admin services like procurement and grants, that sort of thing, to try to consolidate and be more efficient. So you'll see increases in theirs and decreases somewhere else, but that largely explains what happened there. The next one up is our air quality program. That's the blue line with the diamonds. It's basically flat. There's very little UGF in that division. It's largely fee-supported. That's required by federal law. On their two main programs, they have to be fee-supported. The next one up, the green bar, that's EH. We'll be getting into this in more detail, but you see a significant drop starting in fiscal year 14, and that big drop is where we took cuts in our food safety and sanitation program and our drinking water program. There's two divisions in DEC that really have UGF in them, and it's environmental health with the drinking water and food safety program, and it's the water program, which is the kind of the orange tannish line at the very top, and you'll see the similar drop there where we took the cut in the 404 program, which I mentioned earlier, but also sort of across the board tightening through our other water programs during that time period. The red in the middle there, that's our spill prevention and response division. It's taken a slight decline here recently because of a decrease in receipt authority that they're taking, fees that they were entitled to take, but they aren't there. SPAR, as you may know, has no UGF in it. It's totally supported by the response fund, and that's the surcharge on crude oil and the refined products. Kind of the challenge that they have there, and I'll just note this and go on, is that when that legislation passed to add the 0.95 cents on refined product, that was to stem the loss that we were seeing in the decline in crude oil production, which was funding SPAR up to that point to a large degree. The refined product was a real shot in the arm, but we got a little bit of a surprise in that it was almost $1 million that was anticipated, that revenue that we were going to get there that we didn't get, because there was an understanding that there was exemptions under other state laws to collecting that from municipalities and utilities. And since they use a lot of fuel and we couldn't get that 0.95 cents there, it actually would brought in $1 million a year less than had been projected. But for the time being, there's not a hole there. It's just a looming issue for us in our budget as we go forward.
Yeah, can I ask just again on that, as this has been a recurring discussion for a while now, it's still a concern. I mean, obviously that was the legislation we were trying to address it. You've explained why there was $1 million less. But you still see it as a concern coming down the line?
Yes, Representative Pruitt, through the chair. We can get you those projections, but our projection right now, and they're just projections, is that we would be in the black through fiscal year 2024, and then after that we might go into the red. It kind of depends on crude oil production, because that's the 5 cents a barrel, and then, of course, how much refined product is used. So we're not asking for action today. It's just something that I know that we need to keep tabs on. When we did go to the refined product, I think there was another reason for doing that, and that was, of course, that we have about 2,000 reported spills a year, and a large portion of those are refined product, and it makes sense to, you know, tap that, too, to support those services responding to those spills.
One follow-up.
Follow-up, Representative.
How has the flatlining or actually increase in oil production over the last couple of years stemmed that challenge? Like maybe instead of it 2024, we originally would have projected it potentially as 2023 or something. How has increased production impacted?
Representative, through the chair, we can get you the exact, I shouldn't say exact, these are all forecasts, you know, yeah, projections. But my short answer would be not significantly. And the reason I say that off the cuff is that when we were going into that, that led into that change on the addition to the refined product, we were actually living off accumulated amounts that were in the response fund from prior years. So we'd already gone into the red in terms we weren't collecting as much on the 5 cents a barrel. We weren't collecting enough to support SPAR. It's just that we were able to live off the savings for a while, the accumulation on the other end, you know, when we had more oil production.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hartig, as you know, the issue of transboundary mining has kind of been there for the last several years. The administration has entered into a what they call an SOC agreement with the BC government officials. To what level has DEC been asked to step up and contribute to whatever type of increased activities that might come about in relationship to that SOC? You know, I look at your water line quality funding and your water, that particular line, and it looks like it's going down. Is there any money within your budget to deal with this increased interest on the transboundary mining issue?
And before you go forward, would you define SOC for the listening public?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Representative Ortiz, through the chair, Governor Walker and the Premier of British Columbia entered into a statement of cooperation, a memorandum of understanding several years ago, and that memorandum of understanding called for collaboration in addressing transboundary mine concerns. These are Canadian mines that are on watersheds that drain into Alaska and that could impact Alaska fisheries and communities. And so we entered under that MOU, we entered into a statement of cooperation, which are the three state resource agencies, and there are two counterparts on the Canadian side, two ministries. And among other things, there's four basic things that we do under that. But to get to your question, one thing that we are spending more money on that effort is on the baseline water quality monitoring, which is a key piece of that agreement. What we've done there is we get federal funds for a program to look at water quality in the state and report on that. And as part of a national program, all states participate. In Alaska, it's a bit different because of the size of the state. And so what we have to do is rather report on the whole state every year. We pick a part of the state and we concentrate on that for 4 years and move to another part of the state. So what I did when we got into the transboundary concerns, I moved that to southeast Alaska, that federal funding. So we have 4 years of funding for that program through the federal money. And this is all with EPA, and they've actually tried to enhance that funding because they're part of our effort here, too, to support it. So we're drawing from existing funds to support that effort in southeast. But it has a time limit on it, and so in that meantime, we're trying to find other sources.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you. And so has that specifically resulted then in actual water testing activities that weren't previously going on that are now happening?
In southeast, yes, it is. We started last year. We started on the freshwater last year because they're still kind of getting everybody up to speed we did the lakes and ponds last year. Now it's going to be concentrating on the rivers and the marine waters, and we're bringing in other funding sources. So the first year we started on that, well, we built up on the collaborations on the others. The tribes are being very helpful on this, too. They're bringing in funds, too. And they got requests in to Senator Murkowski for some significant additional funds that we're supporting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead. Okay, I believe we're on slide 7 now. Thank you. I mentioned that it doesn't appear on this whole list, but our total department operating budget proposed for fiscal year 19 is around $80 million. And if you break that down in terms of funding sources, UGF, it's only about 18.9% of our proposed budget is UGF, about 38.6% DGF, and federal is about 28.8%, and other, which include things like Ocean Ranger funds and cruise ship passenger vessel funds and capitalization money, administrative money that comes out of some of our capital grants, those sort of things. That's in the other. That's about 21.7%. So the department uses a lot of UGF to leverage other funding sources. Also, the UGF is, as you already heard, is really different, the percentage of UGF in the different divisions. Very little in air, no UGF at all in SPAR. And it's about the funding sources for admin services is about even, 25-25 across the board. And then it's EH and water, again, where they've taken the big hits in the cuts on the UGF here more recently. But starting at the top, that is SPAR, that blue line with the asterisk. Again, no UGF there. There's a small uptick this year from last year, and that's just related to health costs. The next line down is environmental health. Again, we talked about that severe cut there. And I'll say this, on the drinking water and food safety and sanitation, and I covered this with the co-chairs in our overview last week, that really worries me, that cut, because on the drinking water and food safety, those are the things, if we don't get right, could really, really hurt people. I don't want to be overdramatic, but you can kill people if you screw up on the drinking water, or you can cause, you know, lifetime disabilities. And we've been studying the situation in Flint Hills, Michigan, and that's something that you've all read about. That's the water system in Michigan, where they were trying to save money, and they cut back in a number of different areas. And you sort of got this synergistic negative effect where all these things accumulated in problems just festering and developing, and then a lot of people being impacted by drinking high levels of lead, and particularly kids in their drinking water. And it got my attention when you hear that there's 8 or 9 public officials, former public servants, that are now criminally indicted for not doing their duties. I mean, it's that serious. And so everybody's looking at that and saying, how did they fail? I do appreciate that the co-chairs have set up a subcommittee meeting where we're going to talk about cuts and the risks. And that's on February 8th, so I really appreciate that opportunity. But this is the area where we'll be focused on food safety and drinking water in that discussion. The next line down is water. We just talked about that. Admin services, you see a little tightening up there. What we're doing is, as part of our consolidation, we're tightening up our lease space. We've shrunk our lease space in Anchorage. We did that a year or two ago and realized some savings. We closed our Bethel office a few years ago, and now we're renegotiating our lease here in Juneau to cut back on space. We're also taking some additional cuts. Both cuts that we're proposing in the governor's budget this year are coming from admin services, you know, through consolidations and efficiencies. That bottom line is our lab. We have our environmental health lab, and there's just two people in there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So back to the other slide where air quality, it looks like the funding is going up. So now that the borough is the one who does most of the air quality, I am disturbed that we have DEC employees going around and taking pictures for the borough. But we're between a rock and a hard place at this point, because the only grant money we have for changeouts now makes it to where, and I'll just give you the example. You had a single mother who a few years ago got a certified stove. It's at 3.2 grams, not 2.5. She doesn't qualify for a waiver because it's not under 2.5 grams per hour. And so she can't get a changeout either because it's a certified stove, and they're doing uncertified stoves unless I want a pellet one. So what are you doing working with EPA at this point to where in the North Pole area, we've been shut down on our heating for approximately 30 days already this winter. And it's, I think, negative 29 today up there, and quite a few outages now of electricity. How do we, I mean, we had people get certified stoves, and they did it. Now it's still not good enough. And is there any way that you're working with the EPA possibly to loosen up that grant so that, you know, our residents have a way of getting into compliance?
Yes, Representative Wilson, through the chair, those are very, very good questions. We are working and have been working with EPA, and what Representative Wilson is referring to is targeted airshed grants, where we compete nationally for grant funding from EPA that could be then used to purchase more efficient stoves or convert people, hopefully we can't do this yet, but convert people to natural gas for hookups and use these grants for getting people switched to heating sources in Fairbanks, of course, that are definitely needed in the wintertime, that have less production of smoke, which is the PM2.5 that EPA is regulating here and that we're regulating. The grant that the borough currently has through the state, came through to the state, then passed on to the borough, that's where those restrictions occurred, was at the federal level, and it was over the objections of the state and EPA Region 10. I think, and I can't promise this yet, but we're optimistic that we're going to get another grant, a substantial grant from EPA, and that we won't see those restrictions this next time. So we think we're going to get that addressed. We should know very soon.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up,
just so you know, because I think our friends in Wasilla are going to shortly be going down the same line we are, and we have had people fined at $510 for using their stove. And so this is really important. If you could look back, we are having discussions on electrostatic precipitators.
Right.
Right now it is on hold, the ordinance. I've written EPA to find out whether or not that would be allowed. That's only $1,000 versus a new stove. And if you have any kind of studies or any information so that we might be able to get that written into rules to have another option versus just changing out our stoves. But unless we can use it in stage two, we can't do any studies because in North Pole, we're almost shut down more days than we're open. And so here we've got an idea of being clean, and we can't utilize the technology.
Certainly, Representative Wilson, through the chair, we're looking for anything that technology can help us with, including electrostatic precipitators that are used on the stacks, of course, to get the smoke out before it goes into the atmosphere. You know, there does need to be more work on those before those can be, you know, accepted for what they're touted to do. Also, we're looking at EPA rules in terms of anti-backsliding, you know, and we can talk about that more, too.
I've asked those questions. Hopefully, our Alaskan will help us there.
Okay. We're down to the tables here, and I don't know how much time we have left, Mr. Chairman, if you want me to focus on particular tables or try to work our way through these real quickly. Okay. We're on page 8 of your package, and this is the summary for a division of administration. The darker blue you see at the top, that's going to be the whole division, and then the components below that. The only thing I'll say about administration is that they have been very supportive of all our other divisions as we look for cuts, you know, whether there's our consolidation of services, consolidation of space. We've consolidated programs like within our SPAR division. We've done efficiencies, lean exercises across the department. We're looking at consolidating IT services, including state level. But they've really been driving this, and at the same time absorbing a lot of the cuts themselves, as they are again this year. The commissioner's office is included there, as you see. Basically, all the UGF that you would see in the Division of Administration is just exactly what they need in order, and it's comparable to what you see that we get on our federal reimbursement rates. That gives you any comfort, you know, in saying that we're not overloaded with UGF there.
And Commissioner, before you go forward, one of the things we've been focusing on was vacancy factors,
mm-hmm.
and looking at authority that you have for DGF or other funds that you're not receiving. So have you gone back and looked at your department to find out if you are allocating receipts or to different fund sources and then not receiving all of that, or how much of that on a ongoing basis, or have you cleared out some of that? Is that the intention of what you're going forward with.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'll answer that, kind of give a quick overview, then I'll turn it over to Mr. Terry and here to give you some whatever details you need on it. But, yeah, our overall vacancy factor in DEC is only about 4%. And so we have been, usually I think at management plan time, looking at whether we had excess authority there and giving it up, because we certainly believe in transparency and truth in budgeting. And for instance, our EH department here, you know, which I said spread my concerns about food safety and drinking water, there's 124 positions. I think we have 121 filled right now in EH, and we're actively recruiting for those other three. And the reason is we need all the warm bodies we can get, you know, for the work, because we're worried about, you know, being keeping up with our FDA contracts and that sort of thing. So I think what you see in our budget is really reflective of where our expenses and needs are. I think in SPAR, you know, that's probably, or in water, we have higher vacancy rate. Those are the two that are a little bit higher, but I think at least at management plan time, we would adjust those. So I'll turn it over to Tom.
Okay, and more importantly, what I'm asking about is authority that you've got in there for other than UDF that you are not receiving, or what percentage of those that you're not receiving that then you have to make up with UGF.
For the record, Tom Cherian, Admin Services Director for DEC. Mr. Chairman, during this budget preparation process, we have gone through each program, try to identify any excess authority. So we have gone through that and reduced the 19 budget close to $2 million. So we have gone through that. And we will continue to do that in the coming years.
Representative Ortiz.
Question on page 9 here. Your shellfish division, you have two 2.5 positions. Is that the testing that takes place on the I can't remember, PCP or some level of the shellfish? Is that what that is? Is that what those two people do?
Mr. Ortiz, through the chair, Representative Ortiz, through the chair, yeah, we have two sections here in the EH budget that address the shellfish program, and one is the lab, and see, Tom, is this the?
This is the growers.
This is the, and one is the working with the growers, you know, and working with Fish and Game to open those areas, and the other is on the lab. The lab appears, I think, two pages down, or?
Page 12.
Yeah, it's 12 page. Page 12, yeah, it's the second item. You see shellfish there. And that's where you see the bulk of the funds, and you can see the kind of the variety of funding sources. And in that, there's that 25,000 DGF you see in there. That's those are, I think, the only fees that we collect. And those are actually from the non-commercial, non-regulated shellfish.
And the only testing that happens is in the community of Anchorage, is that correct?
It's done at the Environmental Health Lab because, excuse me, through the chair. Those are bioassays. We need to have a mice colony to do those. The group out of Sitka attempted to use an alternative test method, as I understand it, and that didn't get approved by FDA. And you need that FDA certification and approval testing for each batch before you can sell the product out of the state or internationally.
Representative Ortiz?
No.
Okay.
I think we're on page 9. This is still the environmental health. At the top there, that's the laboratory. And then you see the shellfish that we talked about at the bottom. The shellfish program is important in Alaska. You know, we don't have that many growers or that many people going out for the wild shellfish or the other shellfish, but it's a industry. There are several industries in Alaska, including the dairy industry, that are kind of at the beginning stages, and those are more supported by UGF than some of the other industries. So you'll see a real variety in here from zero all the way up to 90% almost that are fee supported in programs in EH. The next page, page 10, we're on now. The first item there, the manufactured food and seafood process, you see a large federal component. That's the $930,000 on federal money. We have a contract with FDA to go out and do food inspections for them because FDA regulates any food that's produced in Alaska and sold outside the state. But they use DEC to do their inspections for them. And so we go all over the state to do these inspections. A lot of them are seafood processing facilities. And that's what gives us the money to get into the rural Alaska and to some of these communities we otherwise couldn't afford to get in. But they have heavy standards that we have to meet, as you can imagine, for food safety in terms of inspection rates and reports and how quickly reports are done, the rates of errors and these kind of things. And so as these cuts that we've been taking, our performance has decreased over the last couple of years in terms of with the federal government. So that's a real area of focus for us, and one I'm sure we'll talk about on the February 8th meeting is, you know, how do we stem that? How do we, with our decreased services, still stay up on our FDA contract so we can do all this other work, too, at the same time?
And I noticed that there's 0% cost recovery for fees on public facilities at spas and body art facilities and all those. Is there a reason why we have zero recovery there?
It's a combination of things, but mainly it's just what can be what they can bear. I mean, this is these are small facilities, and the reason we still keep these, you know, frankly, is because they use needles, and you know, there's risk of infection. So you know, if we did fees, I don't know that it would be cost effective for us. But we constantly look at it. The only fees that we're really looking at the next couple of years are probably in our drinking water program. Those will probably be pretty nominal. At the bottom, you see the retail food, and their retail food inspections is 87% covered, you know, by UGF. Overall, our department has about a little over $15 million in UGF, and I would estimate about $7 million of that, you could argue, is to support programs that can't be covered by fees. We did look at if we did a change in statute that would remove our caps or barriers, as I talked about earlier on direct and indirect, that probably the max amount that we could recoup it would be about another $2 million a year. But that, of course, would have to be weighed against, you know, what the industries themselves could afford, and that would be brought in over time. So those are the kind of dollars we're talking about. You know, if we tried to do more with fees.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I still don't understand, because if you're going to do it for small businesses, for retail food, I mean, there's some that are real small, and I imagine they still have to have the inspections, and you're charging them. Why would you just let one whole group of people get it for free? I just still don't understand. They're both small businesses or small groups of doing it, and there's a cost to the state. Why would there not be some type of fee?
You know, well, I have to, through the chair, I'll have to get you more details on the exactly why one's one and one's the other, but it really varies across the board. We go through a pretty defined process when we look at fees where Mr. Cherian's division goes through all the numbers and say, you know, what is it that's actually costing DEC? What can you recoup? And it basically does an audit and says, yeah, these fees you can recoup, these you can't, would have gone up, and, you know, do we need to do a fee change? And then what we would also do is we have an economist within DEC that reviews then, you know, what would the impact be on the regulated industry? And then, and that's, a systematic look at it by an economist with the best information we can get. We just don't go out and keep raising our fees because we need more money.
Thank you.
Okay, we're on to page 11, drinking water. Again, that's the other one that I'm real concerned about. You can see that there's not much recovered in fees there, only about 4%. But these are the small rural communities scattered around Alaska that have drinking water systems that we provide technical support for and oversight of. You can see it's heavily federally funded there, a great majority of it. And this is the program where there'll be a focus of attention coming out of the Flint, Michigan situation. Federal government's looking at programs with all the states and seeing, you know, particularly those that have been taking cuts, you know, are you performing? Below that, solid waste, similar story, is only about 22% covered by fees, but a relatively large piece of EH. Those are all the landfill solid waste facilities around the state, again, many rural areas. Next is pesticides. That's largely fee-supported. If you sell pesticides in the state, you have a registration fee, and that helps pay for the program. On the next page, we're back to laboratory services. We have in our environmental health department a lab. It's a valuable investment. The state's put a lot in that over the years. It's not a lab that can be supported with fees. And the reason I say that is we purposely don't compete with the private sector. And so the lab work that we do out there are things that either have to be done by a government lab for security purposes, other reasons, or there are things that are research that a commercial lab wouldn't do, or there are things that they just don't have enough business or it's too expensive to do, so it's not a line of business for them. So as a consequence, you know, we're not making money out there. We're just spending money. But it's a critical service in that it's what supports, like, the, you know, the PSP test. That's why we can have a shellfish industry in Alaska. We do monitor different fish in the state to look at contaminants like mercury and report on that. There's been times, and it happens with some regularity, where either in Europe or some other customer of our fish, they'll raise questions about the health of the wild-caught fish, and we're able to give them data on this is exactly how much contaminants are or not in Alaska fish. It's been very helpful to ASME and others that have been promoting that. The lab, again, will always need some UGF, but we're looking at ways of trying to, you know, find money for that other sources where we can. The next page, again, this is an example of a more heavily UGF-supported area, and that's on the dairy program. It's not that large. There's two dairies in the state, one operating now, one that wants is hoping to get back into business this winter. So it's a very important industry for food security in the state, but has UGF support for that. The bottom, that's our food tissue testing program. That's what I just talked about, what the lab does, and that's totally supported by other fees. It's Ocean Ranger fees is what's paying for that. That was a change that the legislature made a few years ago to make that totally supported by that funding source. Air quality, there's only one component for the entire division. The air quality division is pretty small. It's a very, very integrated program where you have people doing construction permits, original construction of emission sources, and ongoing operating permits and state permits. And these people move across those lines as help is needed in one area or another as the workflow changes. And so it just made sense to put it in one component. It's largely fee supported based on federal law. Next slide is spill prevention and response. You'll see a large number there for the whole division on DGF. Again, that's response fund. We talked about that already. I don't think there's anything else new in SPAR that we haven't already talked about. Next, page 16 is the division of water. Over the last several years, they've taken some large cuts, just in the last 2 years, about $1.2 million and have been shifted from UGF to DGF. It was contemplated when the state took primacy of the wastewater discharge permitting program from EPA starting back in 2009 that as the program ramped up, we would try to get it more fee-supported. And so we're in about our third year of the first fee increase after the initial setup of the program. And have a much better idea what the costs are and what we can recoup and whatnot. So you'll see that if you look back over a period of time, you see that we've made great strides in there in that program in switching from UGF to DGF. Next page, page 17, there's really two parts of the water program. There's the permitting and the standard side, and then there's the facility side, the Village Safe Water Municipal Grant and Loan Program. And we've increased our fees in these areas too on the engineering support and plan part where we've used plans for drinking water systems. the cruise ship program. Of course, that's largely supported by the cruise ship fees. On the next page, 18, the Village Safe Water Program. We get money from the federal government. That's 75% of the money that we put out on Village Safe Water, which is construction of water and sewer for villages of 1,000 people or less. And there's a 25% state match. You'll see that in our capital budget. And then we're allowed to take some of those funds that we used out of the capital grant to actually operate the program. So that's the funding source there. Below there, technical assistance and financing, that's our remote maintenance worker program. We have ones out right now in Unalakleet trying to fix the leak out there. That's our operator certification program, training and authorizing people to operate systems around the state, and municipal grant and loan program. That new funding for that's been flat. That's for the matching program the state has for larger communities. But we still have programs that are in our projects that are in the hopper, you know, from past funding for that we're finishing up.
Commissioner spoke about a February 8th meeting. Will that be before this committee, or is that a subcommittee meeting?
Subcommittee.
Subcommittee.
Yeah.
We can send you information on that if you would like, Representative.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. And now we'll go to directly to the court. Welcome back to order, and now we're going to take you last to the court system. And Doug, would you go ahead and introduce yourself and for the record?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Doug Wolliver. I'm the Deputy Administrative Director for the Alaska Court System. And with me today is Rhonda McLeod, who's the court system's Chief Financial Officer.
And by the
next
way,
slide, please.
And we're supposed to be out at 3:30, so.
Okay. This is our mission statement, and you can boil our mission statement down to just a few things. Our goal and the values within the court system are to be accessible, impartial in our decisions, just in the decisions, have those decisions be in accordance with the law, and make the decisions expeditiously and with integrity. And those are the values that the court system lives by. And I can tell you, though, that in tight budget years, there's two of those values that we always have to watch out for very closely. That's one is accessibility, and two is making decisions expeditiously. So the other issues aren't really money-related, but how available you are to the public, where you are available to the public, how many staff you have to resolve cases. Our challenge is to make sure we keep track of those issues as we deal with difficult budget times. This next page shows that, one, I need to wear my glasses more than I thought.
Page 3.
We're on page 3. Thank you. And this page shows both the changes in the judicial branch's overall budget and also our share of the statewide budget. Our share doesn't change much and hasn't for many years. And I'll walk through some of our budget changes that we've gone through in a few minutes. But as you can see, our budget used to go up, and now it goes down. And there are kind of three things that used to drive our increase in the budget. And one of those was, over the years, the legislature appropriated money and statutory authority for additional judges as they were needed around the state and additional staff. The other cost driver for the earlier years were the statewide pay raises approved by the legislature, which the judicial branch is part of. And then another section of our increase was the creation of the therapeutic courts appropriation within the court system's budget. That didn't put new money into the state budget, but it did move for several years all the costs associated with therapeutic courts were spread out throughout the budget. Some were in Department of Law, some the Public Defender Agency, Department of Health and Social Services. And under the guidance of Representative Hawker, he thought this would be a whole lot easier to manage all this, keep track of it, if it was all in one place. So they took everything, put it in the court's budget, and that's where it's managed now. It isn't an increase in overall money, but it does explain part of the increase in our line over there. This chart shows basically the same type of growth and retraction, but broken down by line item. So you can see the biggest part of our chart, as with a lot of state agencies, is personal services. We are mostly our employees. They make up three-quarters of our budget. And the only other category that's seen very much movement is our contractual services line. That in part, it grew for a little while. That was that therapeutic court appropriation that I mentioned earlier. And lately, we've managed to shrink it a bit, and a large part of that shrinkage was finding cheaper ways to access the Internet for all of our court services. And we recently saved about $900,000 a year on Internet service costs. Again, this chart looks at the same 10-year figures, but separates out the therapeutic courts, which is that tiny little blue line at the bottom, and it includes the Commission on Judicial Conduct and the Alaska Judicial Council. They're both in the judicial branch of government, but not part of the court system. And as you can see there, they really don't change much year to year. They're very small, and they're just along the bottom. The next slide, we're on slide 6. Again, basically the same chart, only it's all funds. But because, and the other ones were general funds, but because we're 97% funded with general funds, it's essentially the same chart as earlier.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there any charge for therapeutic courts? I mean, if somebody can afford it, is there like a sliding scale, or is it all just UGF?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it's UGF.
Follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
Why?
Well, through the chair, Representative Wilson, I guess a couple of reasons. One, almost everybody in therapeutic courts is indigent, and I guess we haven't considered the idea of charging people for access to the court, which is other than a filing fee in civil cases. But when you're a criminal defendant, all these people are criminal defendants, and it's part of a plea agreement. So we have never been in the business of charging criminal defendants for the services to associated with their plea agreements.
And Mr. Chairman,
Reverend Wilson.
Just to you, I mean, I think for the ASAP program, we just kind of had that discussion last year about people pay for the alcohol program, or I don't know whether it's a sliding scale. But again, this is a way that people don't have to necessarily be in jail, but a sliding scale might make it, sometimes when you have even 10 bucks into it, might make it to where you want to complete it versus if you have, you know, nothing in. But I think it's, you know, worth at least looking into it. I think some people probably could afford it.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. I made a note. On the next page, these are some of the budget cuts that we've had over the last 3 years. We've absorbed a total of about $11 million in either cost increases that we did not ask for reimbursement for or budget cuts, 3.1, 3.5, 3.5 over the last three fiscal years. On the next page, and I'll show you how we've kind of dealt with some of those, our ways we've tried to find savings. Some of these are significant. Most of our savings have to come, as I mentioned earlier, from our personal services line, because that's where we spend most of our money. We've reduced our workforce by 70 employees, 70 full-time equivalent employees. We've reduced employee hours by closing courts at noon on Fridays. We've used a combination of mandatory leave without pay, voluntary leave without pay. We also now cap our salary schedules at the R step. We cap our salary schedules at the R step. Now, under statute, those salary schedules aren't capped, but the court has, for court employees, limited that. We've reduced costs in a lot of other areas as well. We have less travel than we used to, mostly by having fewer trainings for judges and staff, fewer computer purchases. I mentioned earlier cheaper bandwidth. One of the things here, e-distribution project. All this really is we email a lot of court records that we used to mail. Well, that adds up. We saved about $280,000 a year on postage, paper, envelopes, and ink by not mailing out things. And now a lot of that is just done with emails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said it a couple times. So could you talk about your savings on bandwidth? Mm-hmm. And how you accomplish that?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I'll give you the layperson's understanding, which is the only one I have. We went with even saying it is just about as much as I know. But we have a system. It's called Meraki. I mean, we used to have by. Rhonda, are you familiar with this issue?
Give this a whirl.
Introduce.
Through the chair. Representative Guttenberg, we used to purchase our broadband services directly from providers, and our IT group came up with a device. It's called a Meraki device, and it routes the traffic so that we can get the bandwidth we need for video services. It's prioritized, then for data, and then for our regular email services. This was quite an exercise, but we've ended up. Because in some of the rural communities, it's allocated by community, by the big internet providers. So we've been able to capitalize on that during the daytime when people may not be tapping into their internet as much as we would need it during court time. We've been able to have sufficient services. So in sum, it saved us about $900,000 when we're finished. We still have a few Southeast programs to deploy, but we believe that it's going to work, and we're very happy that they found it for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under the category of your cost-saving measures, you talk about continuing your closing, on Friday afternoons at noon or half days. Have we seen, because you've done that for 3 years now, have we seen a growing backlog of cases? Were you able to make that change without any significant impact on the system overall is the question.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, there hasn't been a significant impact on the system overall. And in fact, there's some benefits to it. It gives judges one guaranteed afternoon a week to work at their desk to do all of the things that they have to do that are not in a courtroom. We've heard from other agencies that it is nice also to know that there will be no child need of aid hearings every Friday afternoon. There'll be no criminal trials every Friday afternoon. So other agencies, too, have time to do the work that they can't do when they're in court. Plus, court employees work. They don't get off work at 4:30 Monday through Thursday. They work until 5. So although it's 4 hours less of court time over the course of a week, it's about an hour and a half less a week. So it's an opportunity for them to keep up with the work. One of the benefits of closing at noon on Fridays as opposed to just reducing our workforce by another 20 people or so, which we would have to do, is we still have enough employees to do the work. And by having that half an hour at the end of every day, the court still closes at 4:30, but employees work till 5. So with that extra half an hour and having a larger contingent of employees than we would have if we had to lay off a bunch of people to make up for the cost savings of closing at noon, we can keep up with our cases. And in fact, later on, I'll talk about our clearance rate, which is a measure of our effectiveness, and we still do get our work done on time.
And just to follow up, I was under the air or the assumption that it meant 4 hours less pay but it's not 4 hours less pay for your employees. It's only an hour and a half less pay per week.
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yes, it's a 4% pay cut, which is an hour and a half. Yes.
Representative Kalshak.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is mostly answered, but on the Friday afternoon closures, have you heard from customers and folks that want to, that suddenly this has changed their situation now that the doors are closed at a specific time?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, occasionally we do. I mean, we are not open when we used to be open. So that's the downside of closing at noon on Fridays. There are some. But most communities get the hang of it. At least the regular court users get the hang of it. And plus, some things are still available. You can still get a domestic violence restraining order. There are still emergency things. Warrants are still issued. But for general purposes, the court will be closed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
In the 32 positions that are vacant that you're holding, are those giving you a larger vacancy factor now, or are they just being held open, not filled?
Mr. Chairman, we actually are holding them because we took it as a budget cut. Over a three-year period, it was the court's goal to reduce its labor pool by 70 FTEs, or for us it ended up being 77, including some part-time people. But we're holding them vacant. Our vacancy factor is a separate piece of that. So we have these 32 plus the people we have to hold vacant, or the positions we have to hold vacant in addition to those.
And those that you're holding vacant, that's because with crime what it is and everything else, you may be needing to fill those, and it's you don't have to reinvent those positions?
Through the chair, Mr. Chairman, that's true. We, by not getting rid of those PCEs, if for some reason we had the funding to fill them again, we could do so quickly. Well, as quickly as you can fill a position.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Oh, another thing, it's still on this slide. In terms of cost-saving measures, I don't think of – oh, yeah, expanded use of video conferencing. You've heard a lot about video conferencing. It's a huge benefit. It benefits the court system directly in some ways. It benefits other agencies even more. But it benefits and in fact, going back a couple of years, you may recall I was always before the committee asking for more bandwidth, because we needed it for video conferencing. Well, we have the bandwidth we need now, and the video conferencing is a huge savings. Not only does it mean that court employees have to travel less because you can attend meetings video conferencing, judges use it, especially in the First District, every day. The judge is holding hearings from Ketchikan that are happening here in Juneau but via video conferencing. We don't have to fly in near as many sign language interpreters, which federal law requires us to provide in court, because now we can do a video conference from somewhere outside of a person who can provide sign language services in a court in Kotzebue. Those are the ways it benefits us, but it benefits others even more, particularly the Department of Public Safety and Department of Corrections. You've heard about it. We now have these connections, video connections between correctional facilities and courthouses. And the big one that we looked at for a long time, because it was just a crazy cost of flying prisoners from Anvil Mountain Correctional Center in Nome to a court hearing that lasts 10 minutes in Kotzebue, and Department of Public Safety is flying three or four times a week, $4,000 each way in a chartered plane, transporting prisoners. It ties up troopers, it ties up airplanes, it costs a lot of money, and the whole thing goes down the tubes when you can't land in Kotzebue and you have to turn around and come back. It's also disruptive for the Department of Corrections, who has to check people out of their facilities, readmit them back in. It was an enormous waste of time and money. And there are still occasional flights between Anvil Mountain and in Kotzebue. There are some things where you still have to be in person for. But that's a huge benefit. And we have those types of connections between courthouses and correctional facilities in other areas as well. But that's been a very big thing and a huge benefit to the state as a whole. This year, unlike the last 3 years, we're actually asking for increments. We went around a long time before we decided to do this, but these increments are conservative. Also, you may remember that a few years ago, the court system and Department of Law were before you all the time talking about the tremendous increase in trial rates. Well, after the budget crisis started to hit, those trial rates plummeted. That's not planning on our part. We don't decide whether a case goes to trial, but we save money when one doesn't. Every trial costs a set amount, you know, costs money. It's not like a lot of things. Not every child need of aid case costs us more money. That's just built into the system. But every trial costs us money because we write checks to jurors and vendors who provide, who fly in jurors and travel and all those things. So when the trial rate goes down, we save money. And when the trial rate reduced, one of the ways we could absorb the budget cuts was because the trial rate was down and we were saving money. Trial rate is now going back up again. And between jury travel, which is a very big expense, and jury fees, where we are this year, in terms of the last quarter of FY17, the first quarter of FY18, our jury fee costs are about $107,000 above where they were last year, and our jury travel costs are about $160,000 above where they were last year. And that's just a cost increase that we can't absorb at this point. So we're asking for a budget increment for increased cost of juries. And you may know also that the governor has a public safety action plan that calls for additional troopers and additional prosecutors. And we were aware of that. We weren't part of drafting that plan, but they let us know about the plan. It was coming. We knew about the extra prosecutors and troopers, and we know that there's at least a possibility that additional prosecutors and additional troopers will mean even more trials. But we wanted our increment to be as conservative as we could make it. We're already projecting an increase based on the last several months of jury trials. There's no guarantee that that'll happen, although since we made the projection, jury trials are continuing to go up. But we haven't built in any extra money for extra prosecutors because we haven't yet seen that. I don't know how long it's going to take them to fill those positions, so that's not part of it. But it is possible that next year we'll be coming back and say, wow, you know, jury trials are back up to FY14 levels, and it's a significant expense. But right now we're comfortable with what we think is just a conservative estimate of our jury expenses. We also are asking for $96,300 for a program manager for our Veterans Court in Anchorage. The Veterans Court was started in 2004. It was the first Veterans Court in the nation. It was started by two of our judges, Judge Sig Murphy in the District Court and Judge Jack Smith on the Superior Court. They're both veterans and both retired now. Jack Smith just retired a few weeks ago. This is a fabulous program. It focuses on veterans, and it focuses on them for a couple of reasons. One of the main purposes of the court, one of the main benefits, is that it gets veterans either acquainted with or reacquainted with the services that the Veterans Administration provides. The court works closely with all the aspects of the Veterans Administration in providing services to vets. And another great benefit of it, all the people in the program are veterans. And for a lot of the veterans, working with other veterans, having them in their groups, going through treatment with them is very helpful. That court has become more and more popular. It can take 25 people at a time, and now this past year they were routinely at 25, 26, 27 people. They've never had a full-time staff person assigned to this court. They've shared a program manager with other therapeutic courts. But now that they're at full capacity, they really need their own person to help manage that court. And that person's responsible for coordinating and all the logistics associated with all the various different participants, all the agencies involved, the Veterans Administration, gathering all the data, interpreting all the data. It's an important position in a very important court and well known around the country as being the very first one. This slide summarizes our various funding types. As you can see, we're almost all general fund funded. We have here included the number of our permanent employees, including judges. There's whether it's a constitutional requirement or required by statute. Well, it's we resolve cases. That's all we do, and that's either a constitutional requirement or something that is, for example, court administration, therapeutic courts. It's just another way to resolve cases, but it's in the statute anyway. And one of the things you'll see there is, let's see, where is it? Something in there about fees generated, service fee. Somewhere in there, there's fees. A couple of years ago, the court system raised its filing fees and increased the money coming into the general fund. At the request of the legislature this past year, the Supreme Court re-looked at filing fees, raised them again, and should bring in to the general fund an additional roughly about $600,000 a year in filing fees. We looked around the nation, we are still fairly average in terms of our fees. We don't want to be super expensive. There are waivers available for those who are indigent, can't afford the filing fees, and we grant a lot of those waivers. But assuming the FY18 numbers the FY19 numbers with the higher filing fees are similar in terms of number of waivers and cases filed, we should bring in an additional $600,000 with that.
Mr. Chair, on that point, real quick.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the $600,000 expectation for the next fiscal year. I believe you guys have made a change. And I can't remember the sequence of years. What do you have kind of an estimate on that first change that you were referring to, the difference between what was provided mm-hmm. to the general fund then yes. as opposed to the next after the change was made?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Pruitt, it was
$800,000
additional revenue from the last fee increase.
Okay.
And that money goes into the general fund.
Right.
Oh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate all the work you've done on that, on the filing fees and service fees. Can you tell me how well those are collected? We've had a couple meetings on other agencies that don't mm-hmm. collect the fines and fees as well. Mm-hmm. Can you just give me sort of a breakdown, just general ballpark?
Sure, Representative Kawasaki. In terms of the filing fee, it's a pretty good collection rate because you can't file your case without paying it. But there are other fees. There are other fees and charges, like surcharge, not that the court puts on, but the legislature has added on fees for certain offenses, surcharges for certain, to support Police Standards Council, all those other things. And those, collection of those, much, much smaller collection. That's what used to, it still does go to the collections division of the Department of Law. And those are like lots of other monies owed the state of Alaska. The Department of Law tries to collect it largely by going after the dividend. But those are separate from our filing fees, which like you said, we're pretty good at collecting because you can't get in the door without it, unless there's a waiver, in which case.
Unless there's a waiver. Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thanks, Doug. I appreciate you following up on the legislature's recommendation on filing fees mm-hmm. just to help us deal with the budget crisis. Is it coincidental that the my guess is it is, but the two increases for jury expenses that are going up and for the Veterans Court seem to about equal the filing fee increase of
Actually, through the chair, that's the first that connection I've even thought of it. So, yes, it is. It is. That's, I get a skeptic might see that different, but no, that is a coincidence. And there you have it. Let's see. Next slide. You also looked at Alaskan Served. And this is from last year, and last year we spent a little time trying to figure out how we measure Alaskans served. A criminal defendant probably doesn't feel like he's been served by going through the court system, but we looked at a number of different things, and these were ways that we thought made some sense. The number of cases filed, 7,000 contacts through the Family Law Self-Help Center, which I'll talk about a little bit more later. All of those types of things. There, a couple of these are just good things. Like 19,000 online payments. that's one of those reforms that, I mean, this isn't brand new for us, but it's going up every year. That's one of those changes that makes sense for everybody. It saves the court time and money because fees that, and fines that come in electronically require less clerical time than when people bring in a check or mail in a check. And, of course, it's infinitely more convenient for the person to pay with the credit card on the side of the road. Most of these are traffic fines. Those are the good types of things. Also, thousands and thousands of online court forms are accessed and downloaded. That does a couple of things. One, it makes those forms far more easily accessible to people. And we have things like, let's see, I think it's our Landlord-Tenant Act was downloaded or at least viewed 30,000 times, and our there's another one that was downloaded about 20,000. Our Small Claims Handbook was viewed 20,000 times. So it's very unlikely that when we printed those forms, 30,000 people looked at them. But when they're online, 30,000 people look at them, and it costs us nothing. We don't have to print all those. We used to print, you know, like everybody, we used to print everything and mail out to all the courts all these handbooks. We save on printing. It's more accessible. It saves everybody money. It's a terrific thing. You also kind of...
Back?
No. Okay. You also asked about effectiveness ratings and measures. And again, not always easy to figure out how to do, but I think we have some good measures. One is our course case clearance rate. That means, you know, every year you have a certain number of cases that come in, you need a certain number of cases that go out. Now, it's not always going to be the same because all the cases filed, you know, the very end of one year are going to be in next year. But this past year, we had a clearance rate of 99% for all of our courts combined. I think the year before we were at 100%, but we're always between 98, 99, 100, and it just largely varies mostly based on, you know, when cases are filed, how many are at the end of the year, things like that. But we, in general, we're keeping up well with our cases. I'd spend just a minute on some of our alternative dispute resolution programs. And most of these deal with family law matters. We have the Family Law Self-Help Center, and we have Stacey Mars is the director of that program. She spends time going to conferences and providing trainings around the country, not at our expense, by the way, whoever wants her. This is a fabulous program. It serves thousands and thousands of Alaskans. And it's mostly family law, although they're now doing probate cases as well, because it's Alaska, like everywhere else, we have an aging population, and our probate cases are going up and up and up. Guardianships and conservatorships are increasing. So they're starting to work in that area as well. One of the main things they do is produce forms. Most people now who get divorced without any lawyers. And about 85% of the cases have at least one party is unrepresented. Over half of them, neither party has a lawyer. And about 85%, at least one party doesn't have a lawyer. People are going to are getting their family matters resolved in the court without lawyers more and more often here and across the country. The only way that really works is if people know what to do. Otherwise, they spend and waste an enormous amount of their time and the court's time. Good forms, I've become a believer in good forms. If you have a good form, you know what the court needs to make the decision. So one of the main things the Family Law Self-Help Center does is it drafts forms so that a layperson will know exactly what to do. Here's my day in court. Here's what I need to provide. Here's the backup that I need to come in with. That's hugely helpful. Another program that is affiliated with the Family Law Self-Help Center, but it's kind of a little subdivision of it, is called the Early Resolution Project. Every divorce and custody case that's filed in the court system is routed through the Family Law Self-Help Center. They take a look at it and they say, is this the type of case that we think could easily be resolved short of having to go to court? They flag about half of those. They contact the people and they say, look, we've got a program called the Early Resolution Program. And how it works, you're assigned a court date. It's usually about 3 weeks after you're contacted or you agree to participate in the program. You go in the morning. There's either one lawyer or two lawyers or a judge or a mediator that helps the couple come up with a settlement. They go to court, and they get their divorce done in a day. They have an 85% success rate. Almost all of those happen within one day. The time between filing your case and walking out the door after one afternoon of court time is about 50 days. That includes the time it takes for the Family Law Self-Help Center to review your case, contact you, schedule your hearing, and resolve your case. The normal route for doing that isn't 50 days, it's 172 days. And, of course, you know, some of those, you've heard of these terrible divorces that go on for years and cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. This program, you come into court in the morning and you walk out in the afternoon, one day, and you're done. And not only is it fast and cheap and non-adversarial, but there's frequently follow-up with divorce, particularly when there's custody involved, custody modifications, child support modifications. The number of modifications following a case that's resolved through the early resolution program is significantly less than if they went through the same typical program of getting divorced. This is another one of those programs that, kind of like paying your ticket online, it saves us time and money, it saves the citizens time and money, and in divorce cases, it saves them an enormous amount of aggravation. In the old model, people burn up a huge part of the marital estate just on lawyer's fees. Here there aren't any legal fees. You're not paying for a lawyer. The lawyers are all volunteers, and it's a terrific program and one we're very proud of.
How do people access that? Is it online? Alternative dispute resolution? Or?
Mr. Chairman, we'll contact you. The court will, like I say, the Family Law Self-Help Center reviews those cases, and then we'll call them and say, we think your case might, you know, if you're interested, we think this, you're close enough to settle quickly. That's, let's see, that's it. You can go to the next one. Right at 3:30.
Are there further questions? The court is getting adjourned on time.
It's part of our efficiency thing.
Yeah.
I'm going to say, it's not quite a half a day off.
Trying to help you with your clearance rate, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. And so, without further questions, if there is anything that people had information, remember, they can send it by email to house.finance.legislation@akleg.gov. And our next meeting will be Friday, the 26th at 1:30 p.m. That's this Friday, and we will have presentations by the Departments of Military and Veterans Affairs and Health and Social Services. And we'll also introduce and hold as our work drafts the Legislative Legal Services technical corrected versions of the operating budget, that's HB 286, and the mental health budget, HB 285. And those are the technical corrections to the budget only. Legislegal has taken the governor's budget, made their corrections. There are no policy changes or anything else in that budget. It's simply putting it on the record so that the public can have access to it, and the budget will be out there that people can start looking at for looking at in subcommittee and amendments that they might want to make. So if there's no objections, we will proceed in that way. And are there any questions? Seeing none, we will be adjourned at 3:30.